David Hyland is an adoptee, and he was one of those, one of many who was at that formal apology. David, hello.
Hi, Nicole. How are you going?
I'm good. What was the feeling when the apology was delivered?
A little bit of relief, I think. It was certainly a fairly emotional time for most of the people that were there. I was in the gallery, and there was certainly a huge outpouring of emotion at times up there. I think it was a fairly comprehensive apology, and it brought up a lot of memories, I think, for a lot of people.
Does it help you in any way?
It's more a recognition thing, I think. There's always been some sort of a stigma attached to it, I think, from anybody who's involved in adoption, whether they be a relinquishing mother, someone like myself who's an adoptee, or, you know, even adoptive parents. There was always something attached to that, the connotation with that sort of stuff.
What sort of loss did you suffer from being adopted? I know you have a wonderful adoptive family, which is terrific, because not everybody felt comfortable and it didn't always work. But do you still sense that you suffer loss from this experience of being adopted?
I don't think there's any doubt that there's a sort of a hollow feeling. It's not it's not something that goes away. It's there all the time. It's a disconnected sort of feeling. And it's something that possibly can't be fixed by just love alone. It's something that you've missed out on and you're not going to get back.
Can you take me through finding out who you really were when some bureaucrat somewhere handed you a bit of paper which contained your birth certificate?
Yeah, you get get on the day after you've gone through the process of, I think, making sure that you're able to handle it all and not needing counselling prior. You basically get an envelope with your documents in it, which detail your very, very early days. And I've basically opened the envelope, and there was a birth certificate with another name on it, with my birth date. And it's a fairly, well, profound experience. It's sort of, certainly shakes you to your core a bit.
How did that affect you?
I really did feel numb, I must admit. It was a very, very strange day to see another name that wasn't mine.
But is you?
Yeah, but is me ultimately? Yes, and there are a lot of other documents contained in the bag that, you know, probably better left not talked about, to be honest. You know, not that they're that bad, but for a lot of people that are involved with my situation, they're probably not the best reading.
Did you ever meet your mum?
Yes, I met up with my biological mother when I was about 30. It was after I had a couple of kids of my own. She married my biological father, which is pretty unusual. And I also found out that I had a full-blood sister who was 3 years younger than me and had no knowledge of my existence.
These are fairly explosive things to find out over your life.
Yeah, they take a bit of getting used to. And I sort of felt for my biological sister in that I'd had my whole life to deal with this sort of stuff. She virtually had it sprung upon her, you know. Mm. So it was, for her, a big adjustment for a while.
Did your mother ever talk to you about you being taken away?
Look, we've had brief discussions about it. I think it's very, very painful for her to go there. It was more about the fact that she was told by the Catholic Church, was the one that she basically assigned a lot of the blame to, that this was the done thing, and at her age, being 16 in 1970, that, it wasn't what should happen. In normal society, you were unmarried, and this is what you must do.
And she did it.
Yes, exactly.
And today they apologise for it. And we can, I guess, be grateful for that.
Oh, look, I think, as I say, it goes a long way to perhaps healing some of those feelings that a lot of the people that are connected with this. And it's not just the adoptees and the relinquishing mothers. There's the fathers, which I think are quite often forgotten. Being a father myself, it must have been horrific for some of the fathers who were forced to give up these babies as well, who had no contact with these children and possibly still don't, a lot of them. It's also the wider families of both sides, of the biological side and also on the adoptive side. I mean, both those families have had contact with all parts of the story, and it's a pretty big day.
Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon and sharing that with us, David.
No problem, Nicole.
David Hyland is an adoptee. Well, Murray Legro was also at the apology. Murray, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Nicole.
Does it have meaning for you?
It had meaning in that it's a validation of the fact that it was never our fault. It was never our mother's fault. It was the fault of a society that was over-controlling, too much influence from the church, and that from that groundwork it allowed people to abuse the laws of the day, which happened so often. And it was on well before 1950. 1920, when the Adoption Acts came in, it started. 1936, they were advertised that at the Melbourne show, they had babies in the stalls for adoption.
What?
Yes, I found it in the Melbourne Argus and Trove. The 1936 Royal Melbourne show, there was babies, three or four babies in a stall for adoption.
Why?
Well, I don't know, but if you go back to the recession period, maybe that was the one way of them trying to, move the children along.
The overwhelming moral shove behind all this, though, was this sort of denigration of young women who were single and found themselves pregnant. What was your mum's experience, and when did you find out that you were adopted?
Well, I found out when I was 34, and I'm 62 now, so...
Again, a fairly major bombshell for you too.
Yes, on the eve of an overseas transfer to RAAF Butterworth. That's how I found out, with a birth certificate made up showing that I was born in Launceston in the district of Hobart. And you don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar to show that doesn't work out too well. When I couldn't tell my adoptive mother, my father had already died, and they were too old. Actually, Dad, I found out, was illegal. It was an illegal adoption from the point of view that he was 53 when the maximum age was 50.
What was your reaction when you pulled out that bit of paper and it had another name on it and another birthplace?
Well, that one didn't have that. That was a phony birth certificate. When I eventually got my certificate and it showed my name, that was about 1990, I looked at it and I said, that's who I come from. And then was the slow journey of about 6 years to find my mother, and I eventually traced her down using all sorts of devious little means, like electoral rolls and things like that. And I eventually made contact with her brother. We had four letters, two phone calls, then her sister rang up and said she can't handle it, so I backed off. And the last letter I ever got from her was a short four-word letter: thank you very much for leaving me alone. And she passed away 8 years later. So I always had that dream of meeting her, but never happened.
That's just heartbreaking, because finding an adoptive or a biological parent doesn't mean that it's going to be a fairy tale ending.
No,
and,
exactly.
And these things are full of emotional time bombs. Mm. Sharon Gibbons, you were forced to give up your child at the age of 14. How was your child taken away?
Even though I went to the hospital with the support of my parents, I had to labour alone, and a sheet was put up, and my daughter was taken from me and wasn't even told whether she was a girl or a boy. I just heard her cry and I knew that she was a girl.
You could tell from her cry she was a girl, could
yes,
you?
Yes, yeah. I just knew. I think her mother knows. And it wasn't until she was actually about day four, and I was told that I had to sign the adoption papers, and I said, well, I wouldn't sign unless I could see her. And they said, well, that's not what we do. And I said, well, I can't sign, I need to see her. And I got to see her. Due to the trauma of it all, I don't actually recall whether I actually held her. I just remember holding her fingers and thinking that she might play the piano like her mum. But that was it. And because it was a spontaneous thing, we didn't have an opportunity for cameras or anything like that. It was just a bring her in, right, we've done that now, now you can sign. And that was the last that I saw of her. And despite having attempted to make contact through the adoption agency throughout the years, I was told I couldn't make contact until she was 18. And I did know that my daughter knew that she was adopted, but... I just had to wait, and I did wait. And when she turned 18, 6 weeks later, I then thought, that's long enough. And I approached the adoption agency again, and they sent Leanne a letter, and she responded straight away, but said that she would just do it as a one-only of meeting because she didn't want to upset her parents, and so she didn't want to betray them. But so we met in Melbourne, and we had 5 hours, and that 5 hours was a busy whip up around to Ballarat, look where you were born, meet my, you know, your sister, meet your grandparents, and because my family, you know, were very supportive of, you know, the process, because they realised at the end it wasn't going to go away, and just because I had given up my daughter, it didn't stop it. You know, like, I just couldn't let it go, and I never let it go, and continued. And it wasn't until probably after I had my own daughter now, Rebecca, that I then ended up going through lots of, you know, depression and stuff because of the grief of having to had to give up that first child.
And you still see your daughter now?
I do, yes.
Even though you only had the allotted 5 hours?
Yeah, I had the allotted 5 hours, and then when my daughter Leanne then went on, 12 months later, had a baby, and then when she was about 15 months old, she just was kept thinking how hard this must have been for Sharon to have had to give up, you know, her own baby. And so she made contact again, and we've had contact. But I was very grateful when I first met Leanne, and she gave me a photo on that allotted 5 hours. She gave me a photo and said, you know, thank you for the most precious gift, life, because she was very aware of a young teenager at that time, really what my options could have been. But gratefully and thankfully, we didn't go down that path.
And you were also at the apology today.
Yes.
Did that have meaning for you?
It was the opportunity to have it openly acknowledged that what happened wasn't right, that there was not the support as far as, you know, counselling. I mean, I never had counselling for 20 years, and I dealt with all the anxiety, depression, which you think it'll all just go away. And lots of people would say, come on, it's in the past, get over it, you know, she's off with a good family, it'll be okay. Well, it wasn't okay because I was her mum and I wasn't there. And I wanted to be.
Sharon, that's an incredibly emotional story. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing it with us today. Thank you for being at that apology and being able to tell us about it firsthand. It does have so much meaning for so many people. And Murray Legro, what an incredible story. And just your courage is something to behold.
There was many people out there with courage, silently living a normal life.
Mm.
And in the background, there's always this. I met a 68-year-old man once, and he turned around and he said, I've had a great life. I've got no desire to meet my original family. He said, but it's with you every day, isn't
yes.
it?
Mm.
Yes, it is.
It's the fact the pain doesn't go away.
Yeah, never. Mm. You live with it, you move on with it. Then every at a soft moment, it comes back to bite you.
Thank you for telling us your stories today.